Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The administration has been taking every opportunity to prioritize Africa, even right now making sure that African Leadership Summit is that annual event that's going on. These are the things that I believe that if we're saying we're prioritizing Africa, then there should be no conversation, right?
U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Trefalos McCormick wants to see Africa as a priority on the U.S. foreign policy agenda.
So as far as I am concerned, the substantive requirements for somebody to become or to contest for president of our nation, I have met all. What is left is what they call administrative.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana disqualifies the presidential candidate of an opposition party. We'll have a reaction.
This week, Action Against Hunger released results from a survey finding that 71% of Americans would be more likely to vote for a U.S. presidential candidate takes a stand on reducing global hunger.
And a survey shows most Americans would favor a U.S. presidential candidate who takes a stand on reducing global hunger. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. Congresswoman Sheila Trefalos McCormick says her vision is for the country to support Haiti's lead as it charts its own path forward towards peace, stability, and economic development. Her remark comes as the international community, including the United Nations and the U.S., launched efforts to help Haiti resolve some of the challenges it faces. Congresswoman Trefalos McCormick is the first Democratic Party member of Congress with Haitian descent with a large Haitian American constituency. She also sits on the House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs, which is responsible for Haiti and Africa. In a wide-ranging interview via Microsoft Teams, Congresswoman Trefalos McCormick talks to me about her views on several topics. They include her vision for U.S.-Haiti relations and the renewal of the African Growth and Opportunities Act, or AGOA, which expires next year. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Are you saying that Africa should be seen as a priority? Because critics have said that it appears that Congress has not really stepped at its game to ensure that Africa is a priority on its agenda.
Absolutely. I think Congress has been stifled, as I mentioned, because of dysfunction with the Republican Party. But let's look at what the administration has been doing. The administration has been taking every opportunity to prioritize Africa, even right now, making sure that African Leadership Summit is that annual event that's going on. These are the things that I believe that if we're saying we're prioritizing Africa, then there should be no conversation, right? It should be every year we know that there's the African Leadership Conference and that's going to be going on. And our only question should be, how do we make it better from last year? What lessons have we learned from last year? These trade agreements, like I said, it shouldn't be why are we hesitating. It should be here is a better trade agreement. And we're even sending people into different areas of trade. And like I said, right now, most of the conversations we're having when it comes to the United States, number one, security. And that security conversation must have Africa at the forefront. Climate change. I live in Florida. We see it every single day. And if we're talking about reducing emissions, where do you think you're going to get the resources to actually have the battery power? You're not getting it in Europe. You're not going to get it in the Indo-Pacific. You're going to get it in Africa. So how are we having these conversations and not putting Africa first? That's the issue that I'm having, and that's what we're fighting for when it comes to change. Now, I'm happy that the administration has been working with us, but without us actually having both chambers, I think we're going to continue to see a lack.
So, Congresswoman, what, in your view, do you think the U.S.-Africa trade relations should look like beyond AGOA?
I think it should be leaning more towards the future of the entire free world. Right now, like I said, we're focusing on markets that, you know, they're necessary markets, but there's a bigger conversation going on. We are seeing more and more countries and islands and even, you know, areas that are close to the water that are being damaged by flooding and hurricanes and winds. So we're understanding and we're feeling it, especially in Florida. We're feeling that you need to have climate change, that we are having climate change, but we have to become more climate resilient. So as that conversation is going on with climate resiliency, and now I've traveled the entire world looking at this, it goes hand in hand with Africa. Why don't we have a climate change summit that has Africa at the forefront? Right? That's what I want to see. When you talk about even energy security, which is huge for us, because we're looking at a time where most people have electricity, the grids are going to be redone. We're investing in infrastructure dollars to rebuild the infrastructure of the United States. So as we're investing in infrastructure, how do we invest in infrastructure that's actually going to bring us towards the future without Africa? So, you don't want to invest in an old way, in an old system, and then you wake up and find that you're behind. So if I had to say what our trade policy should be centered on, it should be centered on a forward movement. It should be centered on leaning into what we've done right and pulling away of what we've done wrong. And it definitely has to include the diaspora. One of the reasons I lean so hard on the diaspora is because, I am part of the Haitian diaspora and I consider myself part of the African diaspora. And I know that when I'm dealing with issues when it comes to Haiti, there is a way for you to handle it. You can't just come in and think you're going to do anything. Haitian people will find it disrespectful very quickly. They will say, I don't want you offended me. And you would never know that. But behind the scenes, they're saying they don't want to work with you.
Florida has been experiencing a lot of flooding. The hurricanes, and it reminds people of the importance and urgency to help tackle climate change. How do you see the role of Africa on climate change issues?
Well, Africa, as I mentioned, is primary. It's very important. And it's important because most of the resources we're using now for energy actually have the toxic fumes and the carbons that are actually deteriorating and causing and exacerbating climate change. And so if we're going to start moving towards being climate resilient, we really do have to have more battery power. We really do have to start substituting and rebuilding our infrastructure to include that battery power. However, to make battery power sustainable, you have to have access to the resources. And so how could you get access to the resources if you're not dealing with Africa, if that's not priority? And that becomes a real issue. And so I think our focus, when we look at climate change, we must realize the work that has to be done. One of the conversations when we talked about why Africa needs to be there, and one of the responses someone gave me is like, well, are we too late when it comes to dealing with Africa? Does China have a stronghold? And I said, well, you can't ever think you're too late when it comes to competition.
Sheila Sheffield McCormick is a U.S. Congresswoman from Florida. She spoke with me from here in Washington. A recent survey shows that 71% of Americans will be more likely to vote for a U.S. presidential candidate who takes a stand on reducing global hunger. The research was conducted by Harris Poll on behalf of the global humanitarian group Action Against Hunger. The findings were released ahead of the recent World Food Day on October 16. The survey comes as officials of organizations say one in 11 people around the world face hunger due to the ongoing conflicts in Gaza, Lebanon, Sudan, Ukraine, and elsewhere. For more on the survey and steps to help guarantee access to food, I reach Emily Bell Tyree. She is Associate Director of Communications at Action Against Hunger.
This week, Action Against Hunger released results from a survey finding that 71% of Americans would be more likely to vote for a U.S. presidential candidate who takes a stand on reducing global hunger. Interestingly, this includes 59% of Republicans who typically take an America First platform. This survey also shows that Americans are actually united in their concern about global hunger, and they're eager for leadership and action to address this critical issue.
I also understand that 69% of Americans think that candidates in the coming election in November should discuss global hunger reduction. Talk to me about this finding.
Yes, I think that Americans are eager to look beyond their borders and realize the connections between hunger and poverty and education, and that it's time to help others beyond our borders. In hunger, we experience in the U.S. hunger, but the number of children dying around the world, which is almost 2.5 million children each year, is simply unacceptable.
During this election period, I understand global hunger is an area without a gender divide. Can you throw more light on that?
That's correct. We found that there's no significant difference between men and women in terms of their support in addressing global hunger. Interestingly, no significant difference among race, income, region, or education level either.
Now, so let's look at the youth, Americans ages between 18 and 34. What are their views on taking a stand on global hunger by these presidential candidates?
Yes, we also found that 78% of Americans ages 18 to 34 support taking a stance on global hunger. So it's actually, it's very hopeful to see how many young people in America, roughly 12 percentage points higher than those ages 55 to 64, who are interested in supporting candidates who take a stand on global hunger.
Overall, Emily, what is the message here to the candidates and their teams for the elections on November 7th?
The overall message is that addressing global hunger is an area of common ground for Americans. So the majority of Americans want to see a candidate who's going to take a stand, who's going to take action.
In general, looking at global hunger, where are we now in addressing this problem of global hunger?
Well, the sad reality is that nearly 1 in 11 people around the world face hunger. And that number has risen due to conflicts in Sudan, Gaza, Lebanon, Ukraine, and beyond. Climate change and inequality are also making hunger worse.
So what is the solution?
The solution is, first of all, we need more funding for agriculture and food security. The U.S. remains the largest donor for foreign development assistance, but we need and can do more. And I think this survey shows Americans' appetite for greater action on this issue.
There are also concerns that richer nations or Western nations usually make a lot of promises about helping to resolve some of these problems when it comes to malnutrition and hunger globally, but the commitment or the fulfillment of the commitment appear not to be there. How do you address this concern?
That's right. I think that a real time of action will be at a Nutrition for Growth Summit in March of 2025. That's the time when all of the major donors, including the U.S. government, will come together and pledge support for addressing global hunger.
Emily Bell Tyree is Associate Director of Communications at Action Against Hunger. She spoke with me from New York.
We live in the digital age, and parents across the world are dealing with the challenge of trying to manage screen time and to understand the content of their children's digital engagement. Even worse, some parents' use of technology is distracting them from their children. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore the new challenges of parenting in the digital age. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
In Ghana, the presidential candidate of the opposition People's National Convention, or PNC, is challenging the decision of the Electoral Commission to prevent him from competing in the coming December 7 general election. Bernard Mona described his disqualification as shocking and says the move to prevent him from contesting in the polls is an attack on Ghana's democracy. It comes after the High Court scheduled to rule on Mona's petition on Monday, October 21st. The electoral body disqualified the PNC's presidential candidate, saying the party failed to meet requirements. But Bernard Mona tells me that he also has petitioned the court to stop the Electoral Commission from printing ballot papers for the polls until the court makes a decision on his petition.
It is not that Bernard Mona has been disqualified. It is a case of the democracy of our nation that has come under violent attack by the Electoral Commission. So as far as I am concerned, the substantive requirements for somebody to become or to contest for president of our nation, I have met all. What is left is what they call administrative. That is to carry a form that I have to fill in quadruplicate, go around 261 districts in this country, get 2 endorsees each. We have done so. The Electoral Commission, rightfully on the 30th of September, identified incomplete particulars, and they said that incomplete particulars of some of my supporters. So our forms were corrected and sent to the Electoral Commission. There cannot be any basis upon which we should be disqualified.
So, Bernard, the question is, what is your next line of action?
I have been to court, and the court said that they will do their ruling on Monday. I'm laughing because the Electoral Commission in court, we reminded the judge that whilst our matter was pending before the court, the Electoral Commission is threatening to go and start printing of ballots. The court told the Electoral Commission that they cannot proceed with anything whilst this case is pending.
But Bernard, some people are suggesting that your party appears not to be ready for prime time because ample time was given. The party knew the electoral calendar. You should have ensured that all your I's are dotted, your T's crossed, in order to ensure that you don't fall into some of these challenges that you are facing right now. And the party, they argue, is to blame for your woes.
First and foremost, I cannot obliterate people's thinking. But has the Electoral Commission itself not made mistakes on their presidential nomination forms? Are they disqualified for conducting the elections because they have failed woefully? But we ignored the errors of the Electoral Commission. Have we disqualified the Electoral Commission from their errors, saying that because of that, they are not qualified? Recently, when an IPAC meeting was held and televised, the Electoral Commission publicly admitted that they made errors and that they have corrected the errors on the voters' register. So if the Electoral Commission is making errors, why do they think that me, I am a robot? Even robots, when you don't program them well, they make mistakes.
Monday, the court will make a decision. But what do you think are your real chances on Monday of winning the case?
I can assure you that after the judge listened to the case, I mean, the Electoral Commission is the reason why the case was not even concluded yesterday. Because they asked the Electoral Commission, you are claiming that the guy did not do the correction. He says that he has done the correction. Have you brought the form to court to prove? They said no. On one of the cases where they refer to one Mr. Atta from the Semankasi constituency, they said that the person did not sign. Then the judge said that, but I can see a mark on the signature column. Then the lawyer came to say, but the signature resembles some other signature. Then the judge said, but that is not why you are here. You are saying that the person did not sign. So if you look at the shifting of reasons, even when they shifted the reasons, the judge asked them, when the Electoral Commission detects that somebody has violated an electoral law, is it the Electoral Commission that asks or you take it to the police and the police will then take the necessary processes? So if you understand the laws of Ghana, I would be surprised that there will be any contrary judgment. In any case, this is High Court. And so I am of no doubt that this case will be determined so that the people's choice of who a president should be will be for the people and not by a group of people sitting at some obscure corner and determining whether I should be eligible to contest elections or not.
Bernard Mona is the presidential candidate of the Opposition People's National Convention, or PNC. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, or ICC, Karim Khan, plans to renew an investigation into Democratic Republic of Congo. It will focus on alleged crimes committed in North Kivu province since January 2022. This, as the Hague-based court aims to address allegations, including potential war crimes and crimes against humanity, and assess all parties involved. For more reaction from the court, VOA's French to Africa Service reporter Eddie Isango reached Deputy Prosecutor Mami Mandiaye Niang on the ICC prosecutor's decision.
So what people need to understand is that the justice system is not equipped with a military force that can be present and stop and arrest the conflict. So what we do is really by our action, prosecuting and enforcing the judgment to serve as a deterrent for further criminality. And in this regard, we have reactivated our investigation, as I indicated. There are some parts which will be our focus. And what I want to also to indicate to you is that we will not be doing it alone. Our approach is such that we will try and encourage and reinforce also the domestic system through different means, including technical assistance. We are also looking at helping the DRC to set up a hybrid court with international judges and prosecutors. And all of those components will be part of the response to the wide range of criminality we are witnessing in the DRC.
Rwanda is accused by the DRC of supporting the M23 rebels, and Kigali, in his turn, accuses Kinshasa of supporting the FDLR. Now we know all that Rwanda is not part of a Rome Treaty. So when, I don't know, what mean do you have to prosecute any Rwandese if you find them involved in the alleged crimes that you are prosecuting?
Okay, one has to understand that the jurisdiction of the court can extend to people who are not necessarily citizens of a member state. You've seen that we are fully investigating in Ukraine at a time where Ukraine was not a member state, nor Russia. So we are investigating in Palestine when Israel is not member of this court. So it suffices that we have a specific link to the criminality by a referral or by some other means, like the Security Council. And in the specific case of the DRC, so DRC is a member state, and whatever crime are committed within its territory, irrespective of the citizenship of those involved, we have jurisdiction to investigate and to prosecute. So this now, irrespective, as I say, irrespective of the citizenship. But of course, what the mean we have now to enforce will depend on cooperation as well. So once we investigate and we have been able to identify people involved, we will also deploy our own means to marshal the necessary cooperation really to enforce the execution of any potential arrest warrants and subsequent trial.
Mami Mandiaye Niang is Deputy Prosecutor of the ICC. He spoke with VOA French to Africa Service reporter Eddie Isango from The Hague. In Malawi, a civil society group called the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, or CDEDI, is calling on the government to launch an inquiry into the plane crash that left former Vice President Salos Chilima and seven others dead. Sylvester Namiwa, the executive director of CDEDI, says the group will proceed with a nationwide protest on October 24 if the administration in Lilongwe fails to meet what he says is demands for answers to the circumstances that led to the tragedy. At a recent press conference, the civil society group says Malawians are not satisfied with the preliminary report of the investigation by the German Federal Bureau of Aircraft to the military plane crash that carried the former vice president, former First Lady Patricia Shani Zimbiri, and others. Sylvester Namiwa tells me that the government should hold accountable any official who misled the public over the circumstances surrounding the plane crash.
Given the magnitude and the sensitivity of that accident, and all factors being equal, the president should have named a commission of inquiry the same night when he made an official announcement to Malawians. Elsewhere you go, an issue to do with a plane crash is a material for a proper investigation, irrespective of who is involved. Here is an incident that happened at around 10 o'clock in the morning. Why did the president have to wait for a very good 13 hours to make an announcement? What was happening in between? Eventually, we have a report, purportedly a preliminary technical report from the German experts that has left Malawians with more unanswered questions.
But Namiwa, if an accident occurs, the president has to wait for all the information that is required before addressing the nation. Isn't it what responsible governance or governments do?
Certainly, yes. But then we are worried about the turn of events. And probably he has been exposed by the technical report, the preliminary technical report from the German aircraft experts, because the president initially told Malawians that the plane was sent back at Nzuzu Airport because of bad weather. But if you go and check into the preliminary technical report, it is saying the plane never reached Nzuzu. Now, that begs the question to say, who lied to the president? Who gave him this misinformation? Assuming that there is no foul play involved, why is it that those top government officials that lied to Malawians, they are still working?
Namiwa, the preliminary report, according to a lot of Malawians, put to rest some of these suspicions of foul play. Why don't you just wait for a complete investigation of this report, for a final report to be written, without issuing an ultimatum to the government?
I've already alluded to that we're talking about the whole sitting state vice president, the former first lady, and the service men and women in the MDF. We can't wait because the report you are talking about is falling short of explaining to say what actually brought down the airplane. It's not clearly stated in that one. Now, like I alluded to, we are not going into the nitty-gritties of the report. We are not attacking the technical aspects of the report. We are talking about events surrounding the incident. For example, let's assume that there was no foul play involved. Why is it that the president is dragging his feet into instituting a commission of inquiry? Why is it that up to this very hour, no one has been fired? Ordinarily, assuming that this incident involved the president himself, the victim, the vice president, should have been in the forefront championing a search and rescue mission. So this report, much as we're not interested to go into the nitty-gritty of it, but it has failed from the way to go because it is not telling the nation what really brought down the plane.
Isn't revisiting this issue bring back the bad memories, you know, to the families who lost their loved ones in this tragedy? Are you not going to worsen their grief?
In fact, you may wish to know that the members of the bereaved family, nine in total, have just formally wrote the president and given him a 14 days ultimatum, and it has expired. In order for the nation to heal, or in order for us to have a satisfying closure on this matter, we need to read a comprehensive report chronicling the tale of events prior, during, and after that incident. You may recall that three weeks ago, the widow to the fallen vice president took to the public on Facebook calling for Malawians to support. I mean, we are just taking heed of a call from the family that they have got a lot of unanswered questions.
Sylvester Namiwa is the executive director of CDEDI. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Still in Malawi, the spokesperson for the opposition United Democratic Front, or UDF, has denied reports that over 100 members of the party have defected to the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP. Dyson Jangia also says the party is putting its house together to be prepared for the next general election. His comments come after the UDF was accused of refusing to participate in a recent joint opposition party press conference about critical electoral concerns they have ahead of the coming polls. For reaction to the criticisms, I reached UDF spokesperson Dyson Jangia in the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Basically, the reason was we are a new committee for the party. We just had our convention. The elections were done just a week and a half ago. So ourselves, we had not yet even regrouped together and internalized. So we thought we needed, first of all, to make good of our house, to put things in order before we can go and face the other teams like the other opposition parties. Yeah, but we are in agreement, in terms of the regrets which the opposition parties they are grieving about. We are in solidarity with them because we believe as a party, our party is the first one, as far as multi-party politics came into Malawi. We're the first, party which governed for two terms. So we believe fairness, also having a credible and fair, free elections. So
Dyson, what do you say to critics who are of the view that to say that you are a political party willing to win the presidential vote, in the next general election, you appear to be not ready for prime time, which they say shows the party is not serious enough to attract supporters across the country to win their vote?
No, that's not true. Otherwise, our party, we are, revitalizing it. And our president, when he was having the acceptance speech at the convention, he made it very clear that this time around, the United Democratic Front will be the torchbearer, in these elections. And it won't go there to the elections under any other party. So we are really geared that we're going to the elections, and we believe that we've got a lot of support. Maybe what derailed that support previously was that because we are going there to maybe making alliances with other parties. So the president has been so clear that this time around we are going it alone. We'll go there, okay, of course we can embrace any partnership, but people have to know that our president will be contesting as a presidential candidate in the forthcoming elections.
But some people are suggesting that, the party has lost its former glory and that it has shrunk in size. And that is why the report of mass defection from your party, UDF, and the UTM, to the main opposition DPP under former President Atta Peter Mutharika is credible because people have lost faith in your party.
No, it's not true. People haven't lost any faith in us. In fact, some people, they are looking forward. Our members, they are intact, only that I think others, even those who had gone maybe to the other parties, like the one you have mentioned, the DPP, right now, after the convention we had, there are so many supporters saying, they are coming back to our party.
Dyson Jangia is the spokesperson for the opposition United Democratic Front, or UDF. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Goldman Sachs is projecting that global data center power demand will sharply increase by 160% in 6 years. It comes as energy demand increased due to artificial intelligence or AI. This as technology giants reopen nuclear reactors to power their data centers. Experts cite an example of the recent announcement by Microsoft to partner with Constellation Energy to reopen a nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island. Matt Crozat is the Executive Director for Strategy and Policy Development at the Nuclear Energy Institute. He is responsible for directing the Nuclear Energy Institute's efforts to identify policy initiatives that improve economic viability of operating plants and enhance prospects for new plant construction. Matt Crozat talks to me about the critical role nuclear power has in meeting global rising energy demands.
Nuclear energy has the very helpful characteristic that when it makes energy, it does not burn anything. There's nothing lit on fire, which means there are no carbon emissions. So it provides a clean source of power, both in terms of not contributing to air pollution, but also not contributing to global warming. What makes nuclear unique compared to, say, other carbon-free sources like wind or solar is that nuclear runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The only time nuclear plants come offline is when we schedule a refueling every 18 months or so. And so we know nuclear power is going to be available all day, every day. And as we begin to see these pressures for bringing new power to the system, we'll add wind, we'll add solar, but we also need this kind of technology that can provide power when other sources might not be available.
So, Matt, are you saying that Goldman Sachs' projection that global data center power demand will increase by more than 160% by 2030. You think nuclear energy can play a critical role in meeting that projection?
We certainly are seeing it right now. And part of the reason why nuclear pairs so well is that the companies that are bringing these data centers into the marketplace, they also have very strong commitments to be carbon free. And so having a data center that runs around the clock and looking for carbon-free power that can run around the clock, nuclear is a natural fit.
Talk to me about big tech's investment in nuclear energy for future AI innovation. The benefits to local and state economies around the world.
Well, we're seeing it right now. Just this week, we've seen announcements from both Google and Amazon to invest in the next generation of nuclear plants. They're going to build new nuclear facilities and are providing enough support to get these technologies commercialized into the marketplace, which is a pretty remarkable step forward. But this builds on some of the things we've seen more recently that are also pretty interesting. We've seen last week Microsoft announced that they're going to invest to take the power from a retired nuclear plant that we're going to bring back into operation. And so we are seeing that these technology companies putting their financial power behind bringing this nuclear energy to the marketplace in a way that we've just never seen before. And this, you mentioned the local support. You know, we're seeing the governors in these states applauding these efforts, including just today, Governor Glenn Youngkin was celebrating Amazon's announcement and what it might mean for Virginia, because they see jobs both at the plants themselves, but also in supplying the fuel and the material that will go to build these plants. So it's a really exciting opportunity, both at the state level and for the local communities that will host these plants.
You know, news reports show that nuclear power is contributing to the shift in U.S. power grid toward decarbonization and how big tech is contributing to this initiative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we're certainly seeing this larger trend towards creating a lower carbon economy. A lot of that is going to rely on using electricity and a lot of power systems to replace direct burning of fossil fuels. And we're seeing that these technology companies are leading the way, seeing that their use of electricity can help to provide the catalyst to bring these new nuclear technologies into the system.
Matt Crozat is the Executive Director for Strategy and Policy Development at the Nuclear Energy Institute. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Thank you. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. For most of the time relating to the war in Gaza, there have been concerns that European leaders have not been critical of the Israeli pursuit of the war. Now we have last week where all 127 European leaders, that is members of the European Union, criticized and some condemned Israel's attack on UNIFIL headquarters in Nakura. The Security Council also took up the matter, and the same criticism, and the United States also made very, very, very strong criticism against the Israeli attack. But still, there does not seem to be any reaction. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu called for the withdrawal of UNIFIL. And it seems that there are not much real information about the nature of the reemergence of peacekeeping. As you may know, from 1960 to 1964, during the Congo crisis, African leaders became very, very, very critical of the performance of the force. Equally, they have developed a serious division in the United Nations about the nature of who should ask for peacekeeping, who should manage it, and who should finance it. And throughout that period, people became convinced peacekeeping of the United Nations was over. But during the Yom Kippur or October War, it became clear that someone has to revive United Nations peacekeeping. And the real push was made at that time by the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council. It came after the Nixon administration issued a nuclear attack. And at that time, the 10 non-permanent members said they cannot sit idly by, even when the permanent members got in agreement. But in doing so, they asked the Secretary General to come out with a new model of peacekeeping. And that was done. And the result was that new regulation principle for peacekeeping emerged. And I could see from the debate or discussion that many do not know the significance of those new principles. With specific reference to UNIFIL, and in terms of the call by Prime Minister Netanyahu for the Secretary General to withdraw it, that one of the new positions of peacekeeping that was recorded in November 1973 by the Security Council was that the Secretary General cannot withdraw any force. Host governments can make the request, but that request will be forwarded to the Security Council for its decision. It was in response to the many criticism made against Secretary General Hutton's from acquiescing to the call of Egypt, Sinai. Second principle, which is important to note, the Council said that any peacekeeping force is authorized to resist any attempt by any party to prevent it from carrying out its function. Tell you, I was present in 1973 in kilometer 101 when the new peacekeeping force resisted attempt by the IDF to put down their checkpoints. And this shows that it's a new ball game. And unless the Security Council take action, the Secretary General cannot tamper with the functioning of UNIFIL. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's on Sunday, Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
My people! Why are we in life? What are we?
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer the great Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the falling of a dry leaf is a warning to the young ones. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Reste près de moi, be my daddy, love.